Welcome to Friday. Welcome to KOW's Week in Review. Every week, as you know, we row a group of panelists out to a remote island so that we can get a better perspective on the week's big events. Today, we're at the Bainbridge Island Museum of Art. It's noisy for an art museum, isn't it? I'm Bill Radke. Thank you to our live Bainbridge audience for coming out. And if you're listening to the radio or podcast, welcome to the show as well. My panelists today are Seattle Times opinion writer Melissa Santos. Hi, Melissa. Woo!
Thank you for having us.
Also with us today, Q13 News political analyst C.R. Douglas.
Woo! C.R.
And a 40-year resident of Bainbridge Island. Such a successful novelist that the mention of New York Times best-selling author doesn't even make us, he just rolls his eyes. Jonathan Evason, welcome.
Thank you.
Beer drinker and author of five novels, including his most recent, Lawn Boy.
Let's be clear, when you say beer drinker, he is literally drinking a beer,
yes,
right now.
Yeah.
A very large Bainbridge
brew beer. I'm going to have to go back
beer
to the bar.
I know,
I
better
get
up
on with it. Let's get into the news. This is what we do every Friday. We run down the big news of the week. What happened? What does it mean? So let's start with the fact that this week, the new numbers came in. They show yet another increase in the homeless population in Seattle and King County. More than 12,000 people counted on a single night this January. Kira Zylstra is with All Home King County, the group that runs the count. She says this is not the progress she wants to see, but that it is progress nonetheless.
Any increase is one that we don't want to see as a community, but I think that this shows actually a slowing pace of increase. This is a 4% increase overall, and that's the smallest increase that we've seen over the last 4 years.
Seattle Times' Melissa Santos, what does this smaller increase in homelessness tell us?
Well, I do think that given how the population is growing in Seattle, seeing only a 4% increase is not as, it's not great, like she mentioned, but it's not as terrible as it could have been. I think that people were fearing it could be. I think that count has about a 3% margin of error, which may mean it's relatively remaining flat. That's not good news because no one wants people to be homeless, anyone.
Especially when there's been a state of emergency declared years ago.
Was it 3 years now?
Yeah,
is it almost 3 years?
Yeah.
So obviously they want to do more, but there was very interesting that there was at least something they've been focusing on, a decline in children and families being homeless. They have been trying to focus on that, and I think we did see a decline in that.
So that was one of the reasons Starbucks, executive, was specially critical. They're opposing the head tax, and one of the things their executive was saying was they can't handle priority number one, the city's not housing families first. He doesn't trust them with their money. Sure.
That's not to say there aren't families out there still not housed. It's a mild improvement, which is good, but still more to do.
CR, there was also a big increase in the number of people living in cars and RVs. What's the thinking on that?
Well, I think the program and the outreach is uneven. So I think they've done good with vets and families. I think they don't have a consistent program when it comes to people in RVs and cars. And that's why that part of the population is up 46%. I mean, a huge increase. I think the largest increase of the homeless population. But the fact that the numbers are moderating as opposed to the last several years where they've been up double digit, I think two things are responsible. One is they've thrown a lot of money at this problem, and some of that is working. I mean, they are making inroads into veterans housing, family housing, as Melissa says, but probably more than that actually is the softening rental market. If you look at rent increases, there's a clear correlation. When the average rent in Seattle and the region goes up by $100, the homeless population rises by 15%. I mean, it is a clear correlation. And what you have seen in the last year or so is a softening in the apartment rental market. I mean, for the first time in a decade, rents are actually going down. So I think that's the bigger factor here, because as rents go up, population of homeless goes up. As rents go down, presumably the population won't grow as much. I think that's probably more to do with it than anything.
In this count, the vast majority of people living outside were counted in Seattle, nearly 4,500. We often, and politicians encourage this, so we often think of homelessness as a Seattle issue. We have on our panel a Bainbridge Island resident, Jonathan Evason. We were talking about how homelessness is an issue of some measure on Bainbridge Island as well. It's no exception.
I mean, the thing nobody's talking about, we talk about the numbers, it's a different kind of homelessness than we're used to seeing. I mean, now you've got chefs and adjunct professors and people with 2 and 3 jobs living out of their car, whereas I don't know, you know, 30 years ago it seemed like there was a higher percentage of mentally ill or drug addiction. You know what I mean? The demographic of homelessness now has really changed. I was in San Francisco 2 weeks ago on tour, and I watched some lady come out of her tent just like, you know, dressed in a blue pencil, you know, business shirt, just started walking towards the financial district. It seems like we should be having this conversation more because it's hitting closer to home. I mean, it's me and you that's homeless now. Before, I think it was easier to say, well, you know, he's got alcohol or drug problems or he's mentally ill. Somebody needs to, you know, make some services available to him. Now it's just you and I, one paycheck away from.
Does anyone have any indication between what's happening with rents, what's happening with the way we treat addiction, mental illness? Does anyone have any sense of how we might be talking about homelessness in the Seattle, King County area in 5 years?
I'm a bit cynical. I mean, I've covered this issue for 2 decades, and they've thrown all kinds of strategies and money at it, and it's only gotten worse, not better. So will it change in 5 years? Call me skeptical, but here's the reason to be hopeful. As Melissa says, they've added more accountability vices, if you will, to the system. So these providers are feet to the fire now. As I said, they're throwing a ton more money at it. That head tax all went to homeless services in a city that's already spending more on homeless than I think LA and New York even. I mean, we have a ton of money going to this. And when you throw that much money at it, more than we've ever done, something positive should probably happen. And thirdly, the reason to be hopeful is they're finally getting around to having a countywide strategy. Seattle has been go it alone basically for decades. It is a regional problem. The suburban cities have not paid their fair share, and they are now, under the leadership of Dow Constantine, a whole new task force, are really trying to change that and have the suburban cities all be at the table, one big conversation, to try and do a more comprehensive approach. That's another reason to be hopeful.
The state can't be let off the hook on this either. We have a huge issue with our mental health system now, and that does affect communities like Seattle. Still working to track down some more of the numbers, but we have such a huge backlog of people to get into Western State Hospital, and these are people who, you know, are the ones that we were talking about earlier that you think are mentally ill, that need help and are been referred to get help. And sometimes they can't get in because others can't get out and get released to community facilities where they can have a lower level of service that meets their needs. So we have other problems, and I think the state is going to need to focus on that now that it's gotten a few other issues out of the way in these next few years.
This is Melissa Santos and C.R. Douglas and Jonathan Evison, and we started this conversation talking about growth, about the pros and cons of growth. You know who's really pro-growth is Jeff Bezos, as we learned this week. Obviously, Jeff Bezos has been growing Amazon in Seattle, but he just told a National Space Society conference that growth is why he formed his spaceflight company, Blue Origins. Humanity must grow. The problem with planetary surfaces is that they're not big enough.
We have resources to build room for 1 trillion humans in this solar system. And when we have 1 trillion humans, we'll have 1,000 Einsteins and 1,000 Mozarts. It'll be a way more interesting place to live. The alternative, by the way, if we stay on this planet, is not necessarily extinction. We could defend this planet. But the alternative is stasis. We will have to stop growing, which I think is a very bad future. It's not the future that I want for my grandchildren or my grandchildren's grandchildren. I doubt anybody in this room wants that for their descendants.
And that's why Jeff Bezos wants to colonize space.
Oh, I'll bet.
Jonathan.
No ulterior motive there. Why don't we just send him and we'll catch up with you later. He's just spoken like such a businessman. No growth is bad. You know, that's the problem with Amazon. The minute it stops growing, it starts dying. Yeah, I think zero growth sounds pretty good to me, man.
I brought it up because
I'm willing to stop knocking my wife up. I'm done. 3 and out.
let me defend Jeff Bezos and defend growth for a moment, because where he's coming from is pretty interesting. I mean, his point is that you can't keep advancing as a civilization actually without population growth. I mean, look at the GDP of the U.S. since the war, even before the war. We've grown our GDP per capita by seven times almost. And you couldn't have done that with a flat population. Growth requires population to generate that and to drive innovation, to drive entrepreneurship, to be the people who consume the growth, that kind of stuff.
But so if there's no jobs for them, what's the, you know,
his
then
point
we're just talking
is,
about a bigger homelessness.
His point is if you're going to keep growing the human race and keep evolving and not just have it be static, you need to just keep growing. You can
but
never.
But why does evolution mean growth?
Well, because our lives get better. I think most of us want to live now than 60 years ago. I mean, we live better than J.D. Rockefeller did. I mean, all the innovations in technology and transportation and all this kind of stuff, and population growth drives that. His point is that if you stop the world population now, you would stall growth. It requires this engine to keep going. And so Bezos wants to just to bust the limits of what the Earth could house and go from 7 billion to 14 billion to 20 billion to a trillion, and you would just keep driving innovation and life would be keep getting better and more interesting. That is his point. But I find it fascinating.
So is he just a second. First of all, Bainbridge Island Museum of Art audience, are you buying this?
How
are you?
No.
So I have a different theory on this, okay? So
I tried.
He's just sticking up for the other bald guy. I know what's going on here.
Yeah, bald guys unite. Yes. I like Bezos for that reason.
I figured that, I mean, Bezos has his own reasons because people are going to need to obviously buy their passages to space probably. So there's all sorts of things that are going on there. But I'm not really sure that, you know, we're going to have a planet at some point if we keep going the way we are. I know this is super negative for, like, you know, we got beer, we're supposed to be having fun. But, like, maybe, I mean, there's a sense of, like, when I heard about it, I figured, oh, yeah, maybe we need an escape hatch at some point. Like, at some point, the planet's going to be okay, but I don't know about us on it. So that's, I was thinking of it from a more apocalyptic, and now I brought the whole room down. But
can I rebut or just respond?
Of course you can rebut. Yeah. Respond.
Well, his point also is that space is really great for a lot of things we do now on Earth that we should move off Earth. I mean, heavy manufacturing, which is very dirty, very environmentally, corruptive, very energy draining. He wants to take all heavy manufacturing and move it to space.
He wants, Jeff Bezos did say this. He wants Earth to be zoned residential and light industrial, is how he put it. I'm not kidding.
And I find that pretty fascinating.
But don't you think we're going to discover that there's, like, pollution that we didn't know about that affects something in space? Like, it's like we used to think you could dump leaded gasoline in the oceans. I mean, maybe that's going to be a problem in space, too.
I think we will have some setbacks on the way, yes.
Mistakes were made.
Yes, I agree.
Jonathan, you
don't
seem...
Who gets to go?
Who wants to go? I'm not.
Well, let's get tickets out to Bainbridge first.
Is this another, like, Australia situation where we just start sending, you know...
I saw the movie Gravity, and I do not want to go to space, okay? You can go to space. I'll stay here.
Look at the people that are paying $250,000 to be on Branson's first, you know, space flight. I mean, you're going to get a line a long way for people wanting to go to space.
So the wealthy people get off the planet while the people with no money to sit here and choke to death. Is that
Jonathan, do you do not agree that with Bezos that growth is the prime directive?
I don't agree with him on anything. I had to sit next to dinner with him once. He was nice enough, but whatever. They put me next to him because they figured I'd be affable. And I was. But me and my buddy Patty just flipped him merciless crap all night.
In this interview, Jeff Bezos was saying that the growth of consumption and energy is not only a positive thing, but it's essential. That's humanity. That's
our
life.
Our lives are better because of growth.
I just want to hear. But the Bainbridge Island Museum of Art audience was not buying it. So I want to give voice to that, Jonathan.
I can't speak for them. I can hardly speak for myself. Okay. I just, you got to consider, we're talking about quality of life. I mean, I think the quality of life was better probably in 1860, man, when it was a little more agrarian. I mean, just flat out, you know, I'm not having to argue every day with my kid about his devices. Technology mostly, from where I'm sitting, doesn't really... positively influence my life.
I'm going to go for the surviving childbirth argument here.
That's a little unfair.
Let me tell you about childbirth,
right?
Let me tell you about childbirth.
Just relating my own reaction to
I just mean psychologically, spiritually, I don't think I'm just not buying the whole growth thing, because if we just keep growing, all we're going to do is produce more and more people that can't maintain a basic standard of living. How is that helping? That, you know, wouldn't we be better off downsizing with a healthy population?
Let's take Seattle, before we move on to other topics, let's take this, our local area, Bainbridge Island and King County and a Puget Sound area as an example. We have grown and we have grown and we have grown. It's made us what?
Homogenous.
Homogenous?
Yeah. Dude, when I walked down First Avenue, when I was a kid, I walked down First Avenue, we had pool halls, strip joints, dive bars, little corner markets. I walk down now, it's nothing but glass and steel and just these terrible, like, boutique hotel bars with $20 cocktails. It doesn't have any...
Has it just moved people around,
before 1962, though. Nobody lived here, you know what I mean? We've had, like, three major growth periods in Seattle, you know, then besides the 1890s. You got the 1960s and then the 90s, and now. And I just feel like every time we just get further from what made the place... I just don't like globalism, I guess. I like regionalism. I'm drinking a local beer. I think you save the world by shopping at a farmer's market, by spending your money. I mean, because it's just all run by corporations anyway. I want to spend my money. You know, if I give my money to somebody I know 90% of the time, well, then the corporation's not going to get my money. But I try to boycott Pepsi Cola. Good luck, man. They own 10,000 products.
So don't you think the influx of hipsters, though, has led to more microbreweries? Obviously, there are people making good beer, but who's going to drink
more
them?
IPAs?
Okay, I hate IPAs.
All they do is
I'm
IPAs.
We never had more beer options than we have right now. That is progress.
I will
Except
say,
that they're
that
all IPAs.
I will say that bothers me. I went to Ireland and I was like, oh my gosh, there's beers other than IPA. My husband's an IPA fan. I'm not. It's a thing. It's a problem. But there's a lot of beer. There's usually at least a couple options, even at the IPA heavy joints for us folk.
Hey, I'm all right with hipsters if they walk the walk. You know what I mean? I don't care. I don't care if they wear skinny jeans or whatever. I'm not going to judge them. If they're spending locally, if they're being good citizens, I don't care.
We're being non-judgmental at the Bainbridge Island Museum of Art with Jonathan Evison, C.R. Douglas, Melissa Santos. Somewhat, we're talking about growth here. Here's someone who's rethinking growth. For 3 years, the city of Bremerton has been running a marketing campaign asking families on the other side of Puget Sound. Do you call Seattle the east side here? The other side. Well, that says it all. The other side. Bremerton has been running an ad campaign asking families from the other side to come on over. This week, the current mayor, Greg Wheeler, canceled the marketing campaign. He says rents and property values and permit applications were already rising before the campaign and pricing out some locals. Jonathan, you got to love
Good
that.
Good for him. That's what I like it.
Yeah?
I think you grow too fast and you lose what's valuable about a place. I just do. I mean, I have no problem. Growth is inevitable. I mean, a lot of people, I'm not going to just grind axes with the new people moving here. I just, if they're going to move here, I don't want them to try to turn it into wherever they moved from. It's just like, you know, try to, you know, absorb a little of the culture, understand the ethos of the place, understand the history, know who the Hayashidas are, know about the mills, know about Pork Blakely. You know, you're moving to a really unique and special place. It really is a special place. I believe that. And if you're going to move here, I mean, you know, we're going to talk about it later. There's going to be all this talk about building a tunnel under the Sound because these people don't want to sit on a ferry. It's like, oh. That's part. Don't complain. If you're going to move here, don't complain about the ferries, man. You move to an island.
I doubt that those little videos produced by the former mayor really had much at all to do with the growth that Bremerton and the Kitsap Peninsula has been experiencing. And I doubt pulling them off YouTube will make any difference in the reverse direction. What has happened in Bremerton especially is you've had this fast passenger ferry service that started last year. You've had the Navy that has kind of doubled down on their footprint here and added a lot more people. And then you've just had the inevitable pressure from the pressure cooker of Seattle that has pushed out in all directions.
And it's not just Bremerton. I used to work at the newspaper in Tacoma, and they're saying, stop saying Tacoma's nice. We don't need more people here. Stop telling people that it doesn't smell bad and all that stuff. Because they also are getting all this... These rent increases. You know, it's like the Seattle thing about just like, yeah, act like it rains all the time so no more Californians come. Other communities are feeling like they have to do that. And I mean, I think though, at the same time, I used to go to city council meetings in some of these towns in Pierce County that were just saying...
You were getting paid for that, right?
Yes, I was. But they were saying, if we can just get one of these cranes in the sky, you know, and it was a huge focus. And, you know, in Seattle, they're all over the place. You take them for granted practically. But this was a huge deal for some of these communities just a few years ago to get one big office tower being built with those jobs. And so, it's weird how quickly it's shifted to all that anxiety that comes with some of that growth.
So that's what great. Percentage of these jobs in tech are actually employing people that were originally natives of Seattle? Or, I mean, it seems to me it's just like an exodus from Silicon Valley.
So are those
like,
the bad people and we're the good people?
I mean, I'm not going to call them bad. They're the people that are changing the face. I mean, you know, I mean, you're bringing in people with more money are moving here and displacing people that don't have as much money.
Hmm. Can we talk about, since you brought it up, the proposed Bainbridge to Seattle tunnel? So just to fill you in,
we're so good at tunnels here, too. So.
Yeah, yeah.
And when they're talking about throwing money at homelessness, that ought to solve the problem because throwing all that money at the tunnel sure helped.
This is a retired civil engineer who lives in Seattle, by the way, Bob Ortblad, who wants a tunnel from Seattle's Smith Cove to Highway 305 on Bainbridge Island. He told the Kitsap Sun it would connect the Kitsap Peninsula to lucrative jobs in Seattle, give Seattle some more affordable housing, at least a way to get there, allow state ferries to reassign or retire 6 boats, reduce the pollution that those boats' diesel engines spew out, and eliminate the deafening wall of sound the ferries create for orca whales. What do you think, Bainbridge Island Museum of Art? They love the idea, so.
But if we could just move this place further out, it would be better.
Well,
I do sympathize for the orcas, but I also really love the ferries. Like, I'm pretty sure you guys might need the ferries and a tunnel at some point here. So I don't know about decommissioning ferries, even though it might be nice for our orca friends that are not doing so great. But
oh, that nice 20 to 50 minute bumper to bumper commute in a tunnel.
Yeah.
Yeah,
it's a pretty ridiculous idea, but it is getting easier to get back and forth. As I mentioned, that fast ferry from Bremerton cut commute time, it's passenger only, in half. So basically from a 50-minute to a 25-minute crossing, you're going to have a passenger only fast ferry to Kingston next year and then 2020 to South Worth. So you're getting, in effect, you know, you could call them sort of light rail spurs, you know, sort of with these fast ferry corridors. You will get a lot more people over here because of that.
We're moving at the speed of an unblocked tunnel through the news of the week with C.R. Douglas and Melissa Santos and Jonathan Evison. Back to the Week in Review in just a moment. Welcome back to the Week in Review. On KUOW, I'm Bill Radke. I'm here with Melissa Santos from the Seattle Times and C.R. Douglas from Q13 News and best-selling novelist Jonathan Evison. Taking his jacket off and getting comfortable.
Well, I already rolled my eyes twice. I had to do something else this time.
He's all in now.
Elsewhere in the news of the week, 3 finalists for Seattle Police Chief were announced on Friday, and then this week, people who didn't like that process called for a redo. One issue is that the woman who had been doing the job, Interim Police Chief Carmen Best, is not one of the 3 finalists. One of the people protesting the outcome was Harriet Walden with Mothers for Police Accountability.
We lay this at the feet of the mayor. We took 97-some years to get a female mayor, and the first thing she does is crush another female.
Crush another female. CR, is that a fair criticism?
I think it is. The mayor took what was a good, high-quality process and mangled it. And it wasn't just Harriet Walden that is objecting. It is people on the police search committee objecting to the process. I mean, they were the folks that were charged with coming up with these names. What happened is they came up with 5 names after a nationwide search, 4 outsiders, out-of-towners, and 1 insider, Carmen Best, who is now the acting police chief of Seattle. And they presented those. But at the 11th hour, the mayor put 5 of her staff members and 1 other into this process and decided to take those and whittle it down to 3 and be those 3 names that the mayor was then going to interview and look as finalists.
CR, before you continue, can we hear the mayor in her own words on this topic? I just spoke to her on KUOW. Let's hear a little bit of it.
We set up a selection process that we wanted to be fair and transparent and to have as much involvement as possible. I think if you look at the end of the day, when people examine both the search committee and the examination process, we had a large participation from communities of color, policing experts, people from throughout this city. I think that the process was one that was a strong process and gave us 5 good names to start. And those names, because the charter requires it, were reduced to 3 names based upon a whole range of factors.
That was part of her defense of the selection process.
Yeah.
That was Seattle Mayor Durkin.
And that's certainly not what most of these search committee people are feeling in a lot of the community. What she's talking about, the charter does require three names to be advanced. But what happened is it wasn't a transparent process. I mean, the search committee was told to give five names, and at the very end, there was this new committee that was put in to whittle it down to three. Why wasn't the search committee just said, give us three names? That would have been how you do it. That is how every other police chief search in Seattle has gone. The committee gives the required number of names. If you had done three names from the citizen search committee, you bet Carmen Best would have been one of those three. You bet. I mean, that search committee was clear that they wanted the mayor to ultimately have an insider and an outsider to choose from among the finalists. Now, that doesn't mean she would have necessarily chose that finalist, but she should have had that option. And we're talking about someone who is widely respected in the community, Carmen Best, African-American woman who oozes trust. She has all kinds of support among the rank and file. She has all kinds of community allegiance. I mean, it's a missed opportunity for her not to have been given the courtesy of being interviewed by the mayor for this position, I believe.
What do you think about the argument from a few of those people who helped cull the field or who were involved in the later part of the search process that said, you know, really they needed an outside candidate? It seemed to point to that. I mean, do you buy that?
To fill people in on that, you know, the Seattle Police Department's been under this federal order to change its ways, excessive use of force, biased policing. And so Tim Burgess and others, and sounds like on the search committee as well, made the case that you don't want someone who has the, I'm paraphrasing, but yeah, all the support of the police union. What you need is an outsider to reform the place.
Right. And what I'm hearing from having listened and heard from the search committee, which was 25 people, was that was a really robust debate. And they were split. And there are arguments for having an outsider. There are arguments for having, you know, an outsider is good, fresh perspective, that kind of stuff. An outsider also takes a long time to, like, get up to speed. You know, there's arguments back and forth. And the point was they wanted the mayor to be faced with that decision and to interview an outsider and interview an insider. And that's not what's going to happen. And that's frustrating a lot of the community. And it's interesting because her most important liability, if you will, during the campaign was the progressive left. You know, that's the community she had to, like, convince and shore up, and it just burns a lot of bridges with those folks.
Jonathan Evison, you don't live in Seattle. Any perspective on all of this?
So all three candidates are outsiders, right?
And yep.
They're all cops?
Yep.
I don't like any of them.
They're all
like any of them. That's two strikes. You're a cop and you're an outsider now. I like the other lady.
This is the Week in Review, live at the Bainbridge Island Museum of Art, and we're breaking down the news with Melissa Santos and C.R. Douglas and novelist Jonathan Evison, and an infamous calling of a police officer happened, as you know, several weeks ago in Philadelphia, and we're going to catch up on what Starbucks ended up doing about that when we come back. Stay tuned. And we're back with the Week in Review. I'm Bill Radke. We are at the Bainbridge Island Museum of Art. Bainbridge Island, home of the cannabis latte. Or at least it was. I take it you all know about this? On Bainbridge, this is a cafe on the island called Cafe Hitchcock, was selling a CBD latte infused with an active ingredient in cannabis, CBD. The owner, Brendan McGill, says, unlike THC, this CBD extract does not have psychoactive properties. McGill says the CBD came from a farm in Oregon that tests their products thoroughly. And he says you can find CBD products in health stores and head shops. Still, the Kitsap Public Health District told McGill, stop serving these drinks. CBD is not approved as a food additive. I just found out, Jonathan, is this true that we're talking about your
brother-in-law?
What do you got?
Yeah. Wow. Give me one of those THC lattes, man. I don't know. I want the kind that does get me high.
All right. Have you talked to your brother-in-law since he got busted by the kids at Board of Health?
I think last I heard, he can still have that there, and he can still have the lattes, and I think people can just dump it in themselves now.
You have it at the condiment bar. It's optional.
It's a pretty good workaround, isn't it?
Wow.
Has anyone here drunk a CBD latte? That was a
one
lethargic...
Person. That was one clap.
Yeah.
Now, listen how slow he claps, too.
At kind of a drop... Kind of a laid-back clap at that.
Yeah.
Okay, well, let's talk, since we're talking about lattes. This week, 8,000 Starbucks stores closed for an afternoon so employees could receive voluntary racial bias education. This follows the arrest of two black men at a Philadelphia Starbucks last month. A Starbucks store manager wouldn't let one of the men use the bathroom without buying something. Manager told them to buy something or leave and eventually called the police. Starbucks executive chair Howard Schultz apologized for what he called the manager's reprehensible action, and he announced racial bias training that happened this week. And this is a clip from the training video that session leaders played for employees.
Today, discrimination is against the law. It's the people and the systems that support our communities that must follow suit. No one's going to do it for us. What can you do to make our schools, our parks, our stores, our restaurants as welcoming and as inclusive as they can be? What kind of country do we want to live in? Who do we want to be?
We all know that Starbucks has stepped into the race conversation before. The writing race together on the cups didn't go well. It was widely criticized or mocked. And the idea was, let's not ignore race. Let's not pretend that we don't see that race is an issue in this country. We're here together. Howard Schultz has always wanted to be a third place where we can all come together. Let's actually talk and have a conversation. And a lot of people said, I just want my latte. I don't want to talk about race with you, the barista, and maybe nobody else. So, but that was, you could call it earnest, you could call it, a marketing ploy, but I'm curious what you think of Starbucks and race today after this week's shutdown and racial bias education.
Well, my guess is this will help. You know, if you rewind the tape of time and had this training in place before the Pittsburgh incident, my guess is it would have unfolded this way. The two men would have come in and asked for the bathroom key, and they would have been denied the key because it was still policy then that you can't use the bathroom unless you're paying a customer. And then
it varies, by the way, from Starbucks to Starbucks.
Varies.
And some
she
have
might
codes
have,
and some
she
are
might
wide
have,
open.
And then when they sat down, she might have even gone up and asked them to leave. But then she probably would have given them the benefit of the doubt on their story. And that really is the crux of it. I mean, she didn't believe their story that they were there waiting for another person to have a meeting. I mean, I believe that's really the fundamental part of it. And that's probably where the implicit bias came in. And this training would have basically said, give people the benefit of the doubt in that situation.
I was skeptical about the training because, you know, Starbucks had a PR sort of disaster on their hands because some of this incident or the tail end of it was caught on video. And that always illustrates when there's a problem and also stokes the outrage. And, you know, it's tempting to say, you know, they're just trying to cover for themselves and do a PR thing. I'm always cynical like you are about the homeless stuff. I'm a little cynical about this stuff. But we had an interesting visitor to our editorial board this week. The Reverend Jesse Jackson was in and I asked him about this, saying, is this just lip service? Do you think this is a real effort to get at this issue? And he said the response matters a lot. And taking it seriously and acting immediately and saying this isn't acceptable is really important in and of itself. And I thought that was interesting. Also, the other parts of that video that weren't like the fuzzy music and whatever actually had some really interesting parts where people of color were saying, you know, when I leave the house, I have to think about this. I have to not stand close to someone, you know, worrying if they're going to be uncomfortable. I have to think about this and that. And, you know, I mean, I think that's good because people who may not have a lot of contact with people of color may not hear that these worries are on people when they leave the house. And so I think there might have been some beneficial discussion that happened with it.
I think also the biggest thing that's going to change is their policy change. I mean, the training will help. But part of the problem here was the policy. And as you mentioned, it was very loosey-goosey about, do you have to be a paying customer at Starbucks? And there's sort of a company-wide policy that you do, but then it's up to individual stores. And so some stores allow you to use the bathroom and some stores don't. And it probably depends on who's the manager on call. So even a given store might differ during hours of the day. So there was all kinds of judgment that gets inputted into these situations. And if you take away that policy, then everyone can use the bathroom, everyone can just sit down there, then you won't run into these situations. I mean, the problem was that when we looked at that video, so many of us have been to Starbucks and we've overstayed our welcome, and you know, we've been there for 4 hours and we ordered something 4 hours ago and it's not even with us anymore. And so we've it's been so loose, that policy. I've used the bathroom at Starbucks when I didn't buy anything, and I've also felt guilty sometimes and bought something, and I've never been thrown out. And so it's this sense of it was very arbitrarily applied.
And
if you just get rid of that policy, that eliminates your problem.
And supposedly they'd been there for 15 minutes too. That's not good if that actually is correct.
Well, I spoke this week to a University of Washington psychology professor who designed a very well-known test. It's called the implicit association test. It forces you to quickly associate photographs of different people with words that carry different connotations. And this is a white man, and he said, yeah, I found an automatic white preference in me. And I said, are you saying you found out you're a racist? And he says, no, it's not. I think of racism as a hostile thing. And, you know, that's a whole separate debate about what is racism. What do we mean by racism? But he listened to the interview online on KOW.org. But one thing he told me was that the key to the training is the follow-up, because lots of people go through training that doesn't stick with them. So, well, are they going to close 8,000 stores again for an afternoon? How is Starbucks going to follow it up? How are people going to respond? Will customers mind sharing the bathroom with more people than they were before? I mean, it's just a lot of this these were private conversations at these Starbucks stores, but we're all going to watch the follow-up and what happens next. So let's pause it there on the Week in Review on KUOW. When we come back, the emergence, the disappearance, the reemergence, the racist tweet of Roseanne Barr and all the reaction that followed, speaking of race. Stay tuned. You're listening to KUOW's Week in Review, and if you're at the Bainbridge Island Museum of Art right now, you're watching the Week in Review. Because we are recording the show on Bainbridge Island right now, and we're talking with Melissa Santos with the Seattle Times and C.R. Douglas with Q13 News, and novelist Jonathan Evason, whose latest is Lawn Boy. And this week, ABC's most popular new show, most popular show, was abruptly canceled. Roseanne Barr tweeted a racist insult at former Obama advisor Valerie Jarrett. ABC dropped the Roseanne show. Roseanne Barr apologized for what she called a stupid Ambien-fueled tweet. President Trump made it about him, asking why ABC was apologizing to Valerie Jarrett but hasn't apologized him for horrible things said about him on ABC. His White House spokesperson, Sarah Sanders, says Trump was pointing out the media double standard.
Where was the apology for Kathy Griffin going on a profane rant against the president on The View after a photo showed her holding President Trump's decapitated head? And where was the apology from Bob Iger for ESPN hiring Keith Olbermann after his numerous expletive-laced tweets attacking the president as a Nazi and even expanding Olbermann's role after that attack against the president's family? This is a double standard that the president is speaking about. No one is defending her comments. They're inappropriate, but that's what the point that he was making.
Does anyone think this episode points to a media double standard worth discussing?
I do. I mean, I think when you make such a big, important firing, and this is really the first of its kind, you set a marker. And you then have to kind of defend yourself going forward about all the other things you are putting on the air. So I think it's pretty clear to everyone that Roseanne was, you know, crossed the line. I think most people feel like the show should be canceled.
Except
not
Fox
everyone.
Picked it up, right?
Fox has not picked it up.
I didn't Fox pick it up today?
No.
I have not heard that.
Unless something broke in the last hour.
I don't know
hour.
If I'm reading The Onion or the Washington Post.
I was wondering.
But I do think that when you kind of set this up, you then have to be clear about what are your standards. And, you know, I mean, Keith Olbermann said a lot of, you know, outlandish things. I mean, Bill Maher has, even Jimmy Kimmel. I'm not saying that they have crossed a similar line, but a line ought to be clear, and it ought to be articulated by media companies about who deserves a show, who deserves in this evolving standard.
Well, what would your standard be? How would you make that line clear?
I don't want to be the guy that draws the line, and I don't know. But I think there's a case to be made that Roseanne is not the only one that should be looked at.
So I think there was a slight difference here. One, I think Kathy Griffin did get fired from CNN for one of her gigs.
Yeah,
too,
I think she did pay
a
price.
But I think he was referencing comments on a different network from her too. But so I think she did face some consequences. But, you know, I think there is a line that when you, I don't even want to repeat some of it, but when you compare someone who's African American to an ape, that is a line that's a whole nother level than I saw.
Comparing Trump to a Cheeto.
Yeah, I mean, it wasn't just that, though. Part of this is it was a tirade. That one was the worst one, but she was calling George Soros a Nazi when he survived the Nazi. I mean, there was a lot of tirade going on. There was a whole lot of ambient tweeting, if that's the excuse. Like, it wasn't just one errant tweet.
And I want to say, to the, I guess, in defense of Trump and Sarah Sanders, is that I didn't hear anyone equating those comments. There's political satire, and then there's just a gratuitous racist insult, which we know that the dehumanization of people is linked to, you know, murder and mass incarceration and you know, on and on. So I didn't even hear the Trump White House equating them, but CR is saying that it is fair to talk about where's the line that
we're
drawing.
Well, I want to maybe bring up the Me Too movement. You know, Harvey Weinstein was a big new marker, and it's clear that, like, that was inappropriate. And I think everyone agrees that what happened to Harvey and just sort of ostracizing him from everything was right. And probably Matt Lauer was on that side of the line too, and probably Charlie Rose. But, you know, but was Al Franken and was Tom Brokaw? I mean, you know, these lines are hard to draw, but I think once you start drawing them, and by firing someone, you are starting to draw lines, you got to be clear about what are your standards. And I'm not here to say what they necessarily should be, but I think it's a reasonable question about all these other sort of crazy comments that you have from media professionals. You know, how are we interpreting them? I will say one thing about how I would draw the line. I think a president is a different situation than a private citizen, you know, or even another celebrity. I think it's pretty fair game to call Trump whatever you want and probably call Obama whatever you want. I mean, I think elected leaders, you're fair game for anything. So I think attacks on the president is a little bit different category.
Jonathan,
Oh, no.
Yeah,
I was just having.
I got bad news for you. You sit up on this panel in front of a live microphone.
You must say something,
and you're going to get asked a question, my friend. Okay. This is about Roseanne Barr and her. You know, originally she was kind of to some people she was a working class hero because there was a show about the working class that seemed to understand their humanity. And you're a novelist. You're trying to capture and portray the humanity of all different kinds of people. I just wondered how you felt about that.
I just think 10 years ago, before the current administration, she wouldn't have made that tweet. I just think it's symptomatic of this idea that these people are being emboldened. I mean, if you would have asked me in 1993 where we are today, I would have said we're probably living in a post-racial society. Because in 1993, it seemed like, you know, we'd made a, you know, good bit of progress in the past 150 years. But, you know, here we are again. I don't know. In a way, it's kind of hopeful because now we know who they are. They're so emboldened now that, like, I know who to. And I'm not the guy that blocks anybody on my Facebook. I like to keep the enemy close. You know, I'm kind of fascinated. That's how I get my news. Like, I'm, you know what I mean? I just scroll down. I got like 7,000 people on my feed. I just keep scrolling. And I mean, I've got a very wide cross section of humanity that follows me on social networks. I mean, I got several black ladies that are pro-Trump, and I'm just like trying to get my brain around that. You know what I mean? So I'm fascinated. I get this one lady named Beavers. I just remember, because, you know, your name's Beavers. I'm going to remember that. Mm-hmm. But, like, I don't like, understand the cognitive dissonance going on in that lady's brain. Mm-hmm. Like, I don't know. I didn't answer the question, but I said something. I'm out.
That's good. A true panelist.
Well, okay, so if you're that curious about everyone's point of view, will you miss Roseanne Barr on ABC?
Well, I didn't miss either incarnation of the show. I've never seen an episode of either of them.
I think it actually is sad. I think the decision was right, but I actually think the Roseanne rebooted show was actually an important piece of culture. I mean, you don't have, look at this. This was a working class family pro-Trump. You know, I mean, where do you see a sitcom like that anywhere?
Where do you see, in the family, basically, right?
Well, yeah, but that went off the air 25 years, 40 years ago. So I think it was actually a healthy thing to have this kind of program. Hollywood is oftentimes pretty homogenous. I mean, I hadn't seen it, but I'd heard about it. I mean, one of the storylines was her sister, apparently, who's an avid Trump supporter on the show. Roseanne is, and her sister is a Hillary Clinton supporter, and they talk about this stuff.
We have a little audio of that, in fact.
How could you have voted for him, Roseanne?
He talked about jobs, Jackie. He said he'd shake things up. I mean, this might come as a complete shock to you, but we almost lost our house the way things are going.
Have you looked at the news? Because now things are worse.
There's a bit.
And that's her sister, a Hillary Clinton supporter, that apparently in the series, they didn't talk for several episodes, and they finally kind of made up. I mean, my family has had these conversations. Yeah. I mean, literally. Some Trump supporters and some none. And so I think that was a really interesting thing to have on TV. It's a real fact of life in a lot of households. So I think Roseanne is crazy as a person and a mess. But on air, the show actually served kind of an interesting purpose.
Well, but it lost all its credibility when she took away the fourth wall and let everyone know that she really is a pro-Trump sort of racist.
Well,
you know
she
what
was
mean?
Doing that before,
if it was
though.
Like a, if they were trying to like...
Well, her problem wasn't that she was pro-Trump. I mean, that got her the job, actually. The problem was she was a lunatic. You know?
I mean, they had to know that this was going to... She was tweeting some out there stuff before. Like, she called people who opposed her on Twitter fascists and stuff before the show started. And there was some other stuff. It wasn't this bad, obviously. But she's been doing... I guess a firebrand.
Yeah, I mean, ABC should have seen this coming.
So, I mean, I guess what I'm saying is the credibility of the show resides in the fact that it's nonpartisan. That's the only way it's credible to me. I mean, I guess that's just my point of view. Like, I'll take a John Irving novel, you know, like Cider House Rules. I mean, it's all about pro-life and pro-choice. And within that book is the best pro-life argument you'll ever read. And within that book is the best pro-choice argument you'll ever read. Both sides are represented. It's totally credible. It's a dialogue. But when you have your cast, so obviously, I don't know. It's just not credible to me.
I mean, that's why it was the number one rated show on ABC. It had a point of view. And it had a point of view shared by a lot of Americans. Like it or not, it was presenting that.
I think that the idea, though, that it was showing these people that don't always agree. Obviously, the main character was supporting Trump, but, you know, part of the appeal of the show was showing these different people living together, loving each other, and not agreeing. But I think that Roseanne's tweets took it, so that message of the show was sort of broken.
She ruined the whole thing.
Because that message was coexisting with differences, I think. I watched like two episodes. So
I mean, they tried, like they have with the president,
they tried to make it
take
that way.
Away his Twitter account. I mean, literally, ABC knew this was a problem. I mean, here's a tweet from 2013. This is pre-Trump. Susan Rice, the former UN envoy, Susan Rice is a man with big swinging eight balls. So she's been saying this kind of stuff way before Tribe. They knew what they were getting into. They tried to close down her account, and they couldn't.
And then you see it on the show, you know, she's reticent and then accepts and hugs her gender nonconforming grandchild. That's like a great message, but you're like, this isn't real suddenly when you see these tweets. And I think that's where it broke down.
Well, based on my understanding of television, there will be another attempt. If this was the most popular show on ABC, someone will try again. I don't know who owns the rights to Roseanne, or if any writers or producers will ever work with her, but someone will try again to have Trump supporters and their loved ones on TV. It's coming.
Right? I doubt it.
All right, so no more Roseanne-type show. Just wait for the TikTok impeachment drama to hit your screens. Final words?
I love Bainbridge Island.
I don't think think I can top that, but I am going to go back home on the ferry and feel really, really happy on the water.
Jonathan, how was it having a bunch of interlopers?
It was great. You guys were very respectful.
Oh, thank you. Yes.
Take your
stuff. We're not all
get
bad
back
people.
On the ferry.
Go home, he says. Jonathan Evason, Washington State Book Award winner and novelist.
His latest. But thanks.
Yeah, you earned it. Lawn Boy is his latest book. And C.R. Douglas, political analyst, Q13 News. Melissa Santos, opinion writer, Seattle Times. Great to see you again here. And thank you so much for coming out, Bainbridge Island Museum of Art. We loved having you. Thank you.